This Friday night is Halloween, and I don't know how many of you like to celebrate Halloween. I know a lot of you do, but there's no question it's a pretty big holiday for a lot of people. Now, when I was growing up, I was told that Halloween was a pagan celebration, and I have since discovered that a pagan is someone who believes something different than somebody else believes. So, you know, everybody's a pagan to somebody. But it was a pagan celebration, they said, held before All Saints Day, which is November 1st, and All Souls Day, which is November 2nd. And without getting into the formal explanation of those two, All Saints Day is to celebrate all the dead people who became saints, and All Souls Day is all the dead people who didn't. So that's the only difference that I could figure out between the two. Now, in some religions, the one I was raised in, Catholicism, it is a requirement to attend church on All Saints Day. So that's what I had to do when I was growing up. It was what they call a holy day of obligation. So even if it's not on a Sunday, you still have to go. And I got to tell you, when I was a kid, there were very few things in life I hated more than having to go to church twice in the same week. I did not like that at all. So I was always told that Halloween was the party that people went to because they had to go to church the next day, you know, and as far as I was concerned, costumes and candy were, you know, kind of an even trade-off for having to get up in the morning and get dressed and go do what you're doing. Anyway, I decided to look up the history of Halloween on Google, mainly because I thought it might contribute a little something for this morning, but I also like to check and see if sometimes things that I was told were true when I was a child are actually the truth. Because as we all know, there are a lot of things that we are told as children by the people who raise us that we accepted without question, that we later found out were not only partially untrue, some of them were absolutely and totally untrue. And sometimes we don't figure this out until we're in our 30s or 40s or even later. Now, some of the things we were taught as kids were not that important. In Halloween, for example, I always liked the history of spirituality and religion, except for the name, which came from All Hallows Eve, All Halloween, that's where it came from. That name was later changed by the church. The celebration itself had nothing at all to do with All Saints Day or Christianity. What we now call Halloween actually came from a Celtic holiday called Samhain. It's kind of a weird spelling, and that started about 2,000 years ago. Now, the Celts, some of you may recall, were a race of people who lived in the areas of Europe that we now call Ireland and the United Kingdom and northern France. And their religious practices were mostly what we call animist, like from the word anima, which means soul. They believed that animals and plants and rocks and everything in nature had spirits or souls just like human beings did. Now, they also believed in evil spirits, too. That was another part of their practice. But the Celts celebrated their new year on November 1st, or the equivalent in their calendar, which they considered to be the very first day of winter. And winter back then, when things were so dark and cold, winter was actually the season that symbolized death. So the Celts believed that on the night before the new year, the boundary between the world of the living and the world of the dead became very, very thin, which allowed the ghosts of the dead to return to earth for that one night. Now, they also believed that the blending of the two worlds allowed their priests, who were called the Druids, you may have heard that term, it allowed those priests to predict the future on that one day. So the people lit these huge bonfires. They put on costumes that were made of animal skins and animal heads, symbolizing the souls of the animals. And they all got drunk and tried to predict each other's future. Now, I remember going to Halloween parties like that when I was a kid. And we weren't even Celtic, you know. But then the Romans, who later on in the 100s or so, about 50 AD, conquered the Celts. They put their spin on the holiday. They added some extra rituals and celebrations and better costumes and stuff, so that's how it expanded. But in the 800s, about 800 years later, when the Christian church finally showed up after St. Patrick and they moved into that area, the church did what they did with most major holidays. They replaced it with one of their own. They took the existing date, but they put their own holiday on top of it, sort of like they did with Easter, the goddess Esther, and the god Mithras for Christmas, very similar dates. So now we all know something different about Halloween than we were taught as children. You can tell your friends about that. But that brings us back to the discussion of how we end up believing things in our life that are not true. Because as I look back on my life, it seems to me that quite a few of the problems that I have experienced, even though I take full responsibility for them, which is what this teaching taught me, most of the bad or dumb decisions that I have made in my life, and there have been a bunch of them, I admit, were at least partially due to things that I had been taught to believe in that turned out to be wrong. Now, it wasn't just things like Halloween or Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny, that kind of stuff. It also included things that I was taught about prosperity, like money is hard to come by and most rich people are dishonest. Those are some things I was taught. It included things about illness, like you have to have surgery and medicine to heal disease, or even the fact that there are some incurable diseases. It included things I was taught about work, like, you know, if you find a job with a company car, insurance, and a retirement plan, you will be set for life. Boy, that one has been blown out of the water, you know? And it especially included things that I was taught about relationships, like that find yourself a princess and live happily ever after thing. You know, that's kind of interesting. So, like a lot of us, at a very early age, I was presented with a number of what turned out to be unhealthy and unhelpful beliefs about God, about myself, and about the world that were just not so. That's why when I started to, for lack of a better term, wake up mentally and spiritually in my mid to early 30s, I went through a period, right when I got into this teaching and teachings like it, where I was really, really angry. I went through a period where I was really ticked off at the people who had taught me those things, who had lied to me all those years, but I was even angrier at myself for believing what they said. Now, in the interest of fairness, not all of these false beliefs that I picked up were taught to me intentionally. My parents, my teachers, my friends, my church at the time, they were not trying to deliberately mislead me into believing things that could ruin my life. That wasn't their intention. Well, maybe the church was, but the other ones weren't, okay? Most of them were conveying to me what they had been taught by their parents and their teachers and their religions and on and on and on. That's why it's kind of hard for the world to change. Sometimes ignorance is hereditary. You know, we get it from the people before us. But something else I discovered that I found very, very interesting is that some of the beliefs that I held for so long were not taught to me by anybody. They weren't. They were just misunderstandings or assumptions that I somehow picked up based on what I thought was the truth, or based on what I thought someone else was telling me when they weren't trying to tell me that at all. So they said one thing and I heard something different. It's sort of like that grapevine game when you were a kid. Somebody tells you something and then you tell the next person what you thought you heard. Only in my case, I heard something that I thought I heard and I proceeded to move on in my life based on what I thought I had heard. That's why I went to the college that I thought my parents wanted me to go to when it turns out they didn't really care. That's why I pursued a career in the beginning that I thought I was supposed to pursue, even though that wasn't true. And that's why I even married the person I thought I was supposed to marry, and that was just for starters. You know, so that's the kind of thing that we all do. Now, that is why now, as much as I can, and this is part of what I have learned in terms of this teaching, I ask a lot of questions about my own beliefs. I don't assume that my beliefs are always valid in the present situation, even though they were valid before. I don't assume that what I thought I heard from someone is what they actually said. I don't assume I always know the right answer based on my beliefs. And I have become much more willing, and I mean much more willing, to change my beliefs when they obviously need to be changed. Now, since I have been doing those things, my life has become much easier. I've noticed, much, much easier. But I could not do any of these things without the help of a regular spiritual practice. And when I say regular, I don't mean every month or every year. I'm talking about every day or pretty close, all right? A regular, deep, self-aware, honest, inner exploration that I use to keep myself as centered as I can possibly be on the spiritual truth of whatever it is I'm dealing with at that moment in my life, which are the truths that we talk about here all the time. Now, anyone who has taken a class with me or with Kennedy Schultz, Dr. Schultz, before me, knows that I am a big proponent of spiritual work. All of our third and fourth year classes, I push it very, very hard. Because I believe that we cannot consistently shape our life the way that we want to shape it without it. Now, I also don't believe that anybody should feel guilty if you don't have a spiritual practice. But I know what it's done for me, and I know what it's done for a lot of other people. Because besides keeping me relatively sane in the midst of a world that doesn't look sane all the time, it also keeps me from getting so far off track that I have to spend a lot of time and energy getting back to the center from where I need to be. It keeps me aware of what is going on around me, but more important, it keeps me aware of what is going on inside of me, because that's where a lot of the trouble comes. But what it's also done for me is this. It allows me to see the world from a spiritual perspective. In terms of human behavior, both my own and other people, it shows me how many of the beliefs that most of us acquired as children and that we see played out in society, how these beliefs keep showing up for us over and over again in different ways, wearing completely different costumes. And these beliefs continue to show up in every area of our life until we recognize them, reject them, and replace them. That's what we have to do. Recognize them first, then reject them, and then replace them. Now, I want to expand upon this idea today using an example from my own childhood, one that I think a number of you could probably identify with. So in honor of Halloween, I want to talk about one of the most popular and terrifying beliefs that most of us pick up as children, and that is what I call the monster in the closet. Okay? So here's a personal story. When I was 4 and 5 years old, 2-year period, my family lived in a small house south of Detroit. And this house, very small, maybe 1,000 square feet, it had 2 bedrooms and 1 bath on the ground floor, and then a little attic that had a bedroom and bathroom renovated into there. That's where my parents slept. But underneath these 2 floors, we had a basement. All right? Now, this wasn't just a normal basement. It was dark. It was cold. I was in Detroit, you know, and it smelled very old and very, very musty. And the stairs going down to it, because it was small, were very, very steep. They were old. They were made of wood. The house was probably 30 or 40 years old. And these steps creaked even when nobody was walking on them, okay? And that's pretty spooky, all right? The floor in the basement, you get in the picture here, the floor was part dirt and part concrete, and you couldn't quite tell where it changed, just like the walls, part cinder block and part dirt. And at the bottom of the stairs, if you turn directly to the left, there was a light, and that's where my father's workbench was, and he had all of his tools. But if you turn to the right, when you came around, this is not a political statement, okay? If you turned to the right and you went behind the stairs, it got very dark very fast. And underneath the stairs, there was a closet, a big closet that my mother used as a pantry. And inside the pantry, there was a single light bulb that you had to turn on by pulling on the string. You know what those are like. But you had to go inside in the dark before you could turn it on. There were no windows in this basement, not even up high, so even in the middle of the day, it was absolutely pitch black. Now, this doesn't sound like that big a deal to a grown-up, but I promise you, to a 5-year-old child, this is absolutely terrifying. In fact, I believed, and I remember it to this day, with all of my little heart and little soul, that there was a monster living in that pantry. And I even knew what he looked like because I had nightmares about him up in my own room. He looked like a giant inflated pillowcase, or like a pillowcase upside down floating through the air. That's what this monster looked like to me. And he had a big mouth and really, really nasty teeth. Okay? I could probably draw a picture of him now. And worst of all, he was completely silent. He didn't make any noise. He didn't growl. He didn't scream. He didn't laugh like a witch in a haunted house. He would just float out of that pantry when the door was opened and do to little boys whatever it is monsters do to little boys. Now, he hadn't done it to me yet, but I knew it was just a matter of time, okay? Because he was smart, too, all right? Whenever I was down there with somebody else, he kept out of sight. All right, I was the only one who could see him. So I figured my best bet was to not go down into the basement under any circumstances. If I didn't bother him, I figured he probably wouldn't bother me. So that's the arrangement that we had. However, there were a couple of problems with this solution. For one thing, I wasn't totally sure that he wanted to stay downstairs. So when I was alone in my room at night, I kept listening for sounds that might be coming out of my closet in case he wanted to move upstairs. And I also had a sneaking suspicion that he had some close friends hiding under my bed, which is why I never got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, okay, for then. Better safe than sorry, I figured. Another problem was my older sister, 3 years older. One day, in a moment of weakness, I told her about the monster in the basement and how scared I was. So from then on, she did what every big sister since the dawn of time has done. She used it against me, okay? So whenever she and I were not getting along, which happened every day or two at that age, she would wait for the opportunity to tell my mother that we needed something from the pantry. And my mom would look at me and say, "Honey, would you go downstairs and get another bottle of ketchup or mustard or spaghetti sauce or whatever it was?" And as soon as she said it, my heart would start to pound. You see, the switch for the basement light was at the bottom of the stairs, and the door to the stairs opened in through the kitchen. So I would leave the door open to the kitchen, down to the basement, and when I started down the stairs, the dark stairs, creak, 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 you know, going down. And on the way down, I'd be talking as loudly as I could. "Well, here I am on the fourth step. Yeah, here I am getting down near the light," because I hoped that my mother would notice if I stopped talking and something had grabbed me, you know. But every time, just as I turned on the light, I would look up the stairs, and I would see my sister's smile as she slowly closed the door. And there I was, all alone, me and the monster on his turf. Now, what I usually did was stand there with my hand on the light so nobody else could turn it off. I'd wait about a minute and a half, then I'd run back upstairs and tell my mom I couldn't find whatever it was we were looking for. I never left the bottom of the stairs. So she sent my sister down to find it, which she usually did, and it really ticked my sister off. It was kind of a game that we played back and forth. But one day, I don't know why, when I reached the bottom of the stairs, heard the door closed, I started walking very slowly around to the right, behind the stairs, and into the shadows. And the pantry door, I could barely see it from the glow of the light, was partly open, about this far, and inside it looked so black, so dark, I was just scared to death. So I stared at it for a minute that seemed like an hour, and I pulled the door open, and the pillow that my sister had propped on the top of the door fell down on me. And I screamed, and the next thing you know, I'm standing in the front yard with my heart beating like that, breathing very hard. And in the 6 months between that day and the day we moved, I never again went down into the basement. All right? Now, that's a cute story. It's a lot cuter now than it was then, believe me, okay? And you don't have to be a wizard to figure out the point I'm trying to make. Now, some people would say that the fear I felt was real while the monster was not, but that's not exactly the truth. You see, the fear was real, no question at all about that, but so was the monster. Only the real monster didn't live in the pantry. He was alive and well in my consciousness. That's where he lived. That's where he completely controlled my every thought, my every emotion, and every single action. And as the years went by, he didn't disappear. He just changed form. So he turned into every other groundless fear that occupied my mind in the years to come. Fear of success, fear of failure, fear of looking bad, fear of being alone, fear of death, fear of financial disaster, fear of getting old. All of these kind of fears. You see, that's the funny thing about fear. There doesn't need to be a real threat for us to be afraid of. We just need to believe that there's something that might happen that might possibly harm us in some vaguely undefined way. And by refusing to face that fear and see it for the illusion, for the false thing that it is, we not only allow that fear to continue, we allow it to become stronger and stronger and stronger until it's all we think about and it controls our every move. Unfortunately, people can use that fear to control us. That's another bad thing. Politicians, the news media, marketing companies, they all use it to scare us all the time. But even worse than that, and more often than not, we use our own fears to control and to limit ourselves. That's what we do. We use our fears to avoid being challenged, to avoid being open, to avoid growing, and to avoid sharing all the incredible gifts that we're meant to share. We avoid taking dangerous paths because we're afraid of where those paths might lead. We avoid doing things in a different way because we're afraid of what we might look like. We avoid opening doors because we're afraid of what might be behind them. And all the time, the only danger that we are really facing, the only danger, is the doubt and the fear that we are nurturing in our own consciousness. That's it. Now, every great spiritual teacher from the beginning has told us that fear blocks our ability to know something better. It drains our energy, it stifles our creativity, and it reins in the good part of our imagination, which is really too bad, because energy, creativity, and imagination are the spiritual qualities that we all have that allow us to create an answer when a question arises, to create a solution when a problem appears to have us stopped. Now, fear in itself is not a bad thing. Fear is actually a perfectly natural reaction whenever we feel threatened. But the purpose of fear is not to stop us. Its purpose is to get us to stop and think. So fear is an extremely limited tool that keeps us from doing something dangerous or something dumb when a more intelligent option is available. Like fight or flight, same thing. We may need to run away because we're scared so that we can live to fight another day. But when fear takes on a greater role in our life, when fear itself becomes the thing that we are trying to avoid, we also end up avoiding the possibilities that lie on the other side, that sit behind the door. Now, Dr. Holmes tells a story. It's not in The Science of Mind. It's one of his other books. And he tells a story in one of his talks about a man who had a nightmare where he dreamt that there was this horrible monster standing at the foot of his bed, leaning over, drooling with these big teeth and these hungry eyes. And the man pulls his blanket up to his neck and he says to the monster in a shaky voice, "What are you going to do to me?" And the monster shrugs and says, "I don't know, it's your dream." All right? It's a good story. That's the way we need to start looking at our fears. Because if we truly believe that we are co-creators with God of our experience, what could there possibly be for us to be afraid of? What could there be? You know, the most profound spiritual statement on fear ever made was made by a politician. FDR, "We have nothing to fear but fear itself." That's an incredibly powerful, profound statement. And those are excellent words for us to remember today. Because it's time for us to recognize that the fear is now worse than the problems that we have. You see, the problems may inconvenience us, or they may challenge us, but the fear will paralyze us. The fear will paralyze us. Now today, there are a lot of doors out there with monsters hiding behind them. At least that's what some people would like us to believe. There's a lot of fear about how the election is going to turn out. There's a lot of fear about where the stock market is going to go. There's a lot of fear about what the terrorists are going to do next. There's fear about overpopulation, global warming, and the spread of disease. These things are big, big, scary things that we're told about. We need to stop worrying about all those nightmare scenarios and start working together to figure out the right next thing to do. That's where our energy needs to be put. Now, these are challenges that need a solution. Yes, I'm not denying that. But being afraid doesn't help. So this is actually a time, right now, in this world that we're living in today, for what we might call spiritual courage, which means it's time for us to start sharing our spiritual strength wherever we can and to recognize the spiritual strength that exists in every other person. This is a time for us to remember that anything is possible for people who are open to divine possibilities. Anything at all. And who knows? If we'd only start opening doors instead of building walls like we've been doing, instead of monsters, we might just find some answers. And in the process, we may also discover that there was nothing to be afraid of in the first place. And that's probably the real lesson. So everybody have a nice Halloween. This is the truth in your life. And this is the truth in mine. And so it is. And so it is. All right. Thank you. Okay. So let's take a few moments. And in this time, let's recognize honestly what is inside of us. Let's recognize, first of all, that this world is far greater than we've ever even imagined. There are possibilities available to us that we have not touched. There are healings that are possible that we have not yet conceived of. But we also need to be honest as we look at the world, to also be honest about what is in us. What do we fear? What are the things inside of us that make us get tight and rigid and withdraw from other people? What are the fears that we are holding on to, and why are we holding them so tightly? As we begin to recognize this, we realize that many of the fears within us come from beliefs about what is outside of us. So as we begin to transform our beliefs from what we have seen to what we know, from what we have experienced to what we feel in this moment, this presence within us, as we transform our beliefs with that conscious power, the fear begins to fade. The fear begins to fade completely. And we begin to be in the center, recognizing that we are now part of the healing. We are part of the solution. So I invite you to take a few moments now in the silence of your own heart and mind. And in this silence, ask yourself one question: what am I afraid of? And be honest. And whatever it is that you fear, whether it's being alone, losing money, losing your health, aging, illness, whatever it happens to be, if there's anything, place it right there in the center of your mind's eye and see it and smile and tell it that it is no longer welcome in your life. Take these few moments for yourself in silence. With gratitude for this awareness and a clear understanding of its sacred significance in our life, we recognize now the truth of our being, that there is nothing to fear, that there is nothing but spirit everywhere. And as we look beyond the closed doors, look beyond the fear, we see the presence of spirit smiling back at the spirit in us, because they are one and the same. So as we recognize and accept this truth, we give thanks for this greater awareness. We leave this place today opened, transformed, and transcending all the fears of the world, because they no longer belong to us. We give them away to whoever wants to play with them, but we are not playing with them anymore. Knowing this is the truth, we release this knowing into consciousness. It is now our truth. From this moment on, we accept it completely, and so it is.